And it is today's Topical Currents, Monday edition. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Well, this hour we discuss the history, the pros, and the cons of public charter schools. The Center for Education Reform says 74% of Americans support parental rights to education choice. On the con side, it said that charter schools divert funds from already strapped school districts. Joining us now is Ember Reichgott-Jung. She's a former Minnesota legislator who first proposed charter schools in 1991. She's also published a book which chronicles the charter school movement, and she joins us from Minneapolis. Welcome to you. Thank you for being with us. Ms. Jung. Well, I guess we'll work on that. Okay. We also have another guest.
Yes, also with us is retired educator Anthony Cody. He taught for 24 years in mostly low-income schools in Oakland, California, and is a charter school critic. He joins us from Willits, California. Welcome to you, Mr. Cody.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
Well, do we have Ms. Jung?
Ms. Jung, are you on the line? Well, we'll be working on it.
Okay, well, why don't we begin with you then,
Mr. Cody.
Mr. Cody, we have. But introduce yourself, give us a little background about yourself, and why you take your position that you do against charter schools.
Sure. Well, I, as you mentioned, I worked for many years in the Oakland schools and high poverty schools, and I saw that public schools are really doing their best to serve all the students that come through the door. And what we saw in my school was a lot of times mid-year we would get these students transferring in from some of the charter schools in the town, students that had been canceled out or bounced out because they were discipline problems. We, of course, we're a school that has to accept all the children that come to the door, and the charter schools effectively are excluding children that are more expensive or more difficult to educate. And they tend to do a very focused program, focused on test scores, and then they're competing in effect with the public schools, but they're not accepting the students that are more difficult or more expensive to educate. In Florida, I've just been reading up on charter schools in Florida. 86% of the charter schools in Florida don't serve a single student with a severe disability. More than half of the district schools in Florida do serve students like that. So you have a sort of a dual system being created where the public schools are required by law to accept all the students. The charter schools are very selective, and then public funds are being diverted to those charter schools. That's my biggest concern, is that the public schools are under huge pressure to raise test scores, and then they're competing with these schools and losing funds to these schools.
Some of the proponents of public charter schools, though, say that actually charter schools can bring new funding into a district by taking dropouts, getting homeschooled children, and also students from private schools.
Well, you know, I write a blog at Education Week, and I've written a bit about charter schools. And I visited a charter school in Albuquerque, New Mexico, that actually does recruit students who are at risk for dropping out. And, you know, I think that's a fantastic thing. This particular school has a program that is really, they work with the local building trades, with the carpenters and the contractors, and they have a program that's really focused around the construction industry. And so they're not only teaching students, the academic skills, but they're also doing a very project-oriented curriculum that really engages students that otherwise would drop out. And I think that's really a wonderful thing. So I think there are some charter schools that are doing, that are doing well and are taking students, that might not be served by the mainstream education system. But that's more the exception than the rule, unfortunately. And a lot of charters are more doing this very test-focused academic preparation that is really not serving students very well, and is also excluding students who won't sort of comply or fit into that, into their model.
We do now have Amber Reichgott Young on the line. Is that correct?
Hello, I'm so glad to be here. Thank you.
She's a former Minnesota legislator who first proposed charter schools in 1991. She's also published a book which chronicles the charter school movement, and she's joining us from Minneapolis.
Hi, Ms. Young. Good to have you now. So we've just had Anthony Cody in. He's talked about what he thought were some of the problems with charter schools. So now, if you'll explain a little bit about your background and your position on charter schools and why you take that position.
Very well, thank you. Well, my name is Amber Reichgott Young, and I am the author of the first charter school law in the nation here in Minnesota, in cold, freezing Minnesota, I might add. It has now been over 20 years since chartering was introduced to the nation in 1991. And in that 20 years, I think it's been interesting to watch the growth. And to my surprise, today, it has grown to a great extent. Over 2.3 million students are attending over 6,000 public charter schools in 42 states and the District of Columbia. And perhaps to the most important point, 1 million names are on waiting lists around the country. And also, to my surprise, this last recent poll, September Cap and Gallup poll, indicated that 70% of the American public supports chartering. Now, I'm a Democrat and a Democratic former state senator, and when I introduced the legislation back in 1991, there were really three things that came together, and I think this really gives the rationale and maybe addresses some points that Mr. Cody just brought up. First of all, we in Minnesota had created open enrollment, and that was the opportunity for children to go to any public school of their choice in Minnesota. And once you had open enrollment, the question arose, well, once you have more access to choices, what if all the choices are the same? And what if the choices aren't in the neighborhoods of the parent? And so we looked at this idea of chartering. The idea of chartering actually came from a second visionary, and that is Al Shanker, the president of the American Federation of Teachers. He was the one who came to Minnesota and proposed chartering or chartered schools as a way for teachers to have that professional opportunity to lead, to be the professionals they are, to have the autonomy they need to do what they do best in the classroom. And he told us when he came to Minnesota that the districts, the K-12 districts, were in a situation where they could take their customers for granted. And we agreed. And so then a third group of people, of civic leaders, got together. We were civic leaders from business and labor and unions and educators, and we got together to flesh out this idea of chartered schools that Mr. Shanker had talked with us about. And that is how chartering came about. It came about from the middle of the political spectrum, and it now is serving many, many students and doing very well. Of the many different studies that have been done, 15 of the 16 most recent studies on chartering show that charter public school students are doing better than their traditional peers in district schools.
Tell us, Amber Young, exactly what is the difference between a public charter school and a traditional public school?
That's a really great question, and the difference is this. First of all, they, as you mentioned, they are all public, so that's really important. But what chartering is, it allows someone other than the K-12 public school district to deliver public education, groups like teachers and parents. So the key of chartering was to create choices outside the current system in order to make the K-12 system more responsive. Now, in return for granting the group autonomy and independence, the school leaders commit to accountability in the performance contract. The very goals, the achievement goals that they must reach in academic performance are in that contract, and they must live up to it. And they have to live up to the performance commitments, or the school can be closed. And that kind of accountability is what is not present in our district schools. So in many ways, charters trade regulation for results and bureaucracy for accountability.
If this trend continues, would it make it where local school boards actually are only funders and not in charge of curriculum and teacher hiring and...
Exactly. In fact, that autonomy is what gives the charter schools the opportunities and the choices that the parents and families so want across this nation. That's why there's 70% support for it. And here's what happens. There's an authorizer in a state like Florida. An authorizer agrees to oversee the charter school. They enter into a contract with the charter school leaders, and the performance commitments are in that.
So that would take regulation of the schools out of the hands of elected officials.
It puts the opportunity to create new and innovative ideas in the hands of the school leaders, as overseen by an authorized. And they have to stay accountable to all the state standards in education, federal and state standards in education, so that they that is not different for public charter schools as than from district charter schools.
Mr. Cody, we're going to give you a chance to respond and also to address, Ms. Young, some of the concerns that Mr. Cody did bring up that you haven't yet addressed about kids with disabilities and excluding more difficult students to educate, et cetera. But we need to take a break on Topical Currents. Ember Reichscott-Young is a former Minnesota legislator who first proposed charter schools in 1991, and educator Anthony Cody taught for 24 years in low-income schools in Oakland, California, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Monday's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and we're talking about charter schools today, the pros and cons, with Ember Reichscott-Young, a former Minnesota legislator who first proposed charter schools in 1991. And also with us is educator Anthony Cody, who taught for 24 years in mostly low-income schools in Oakland, California, and is a charter school critic. Mr. Cody, would you, although Ms. Young hasn't addressed all your concerns yet, but would you like to respond to...
Sure. Well, one thing, you know, charter school advocates make a big deal about how charter schools are public schools. In fact, every time there's a court case where charter schools are brought to task for misappropriating funds, for example, there was a school in California that misappropriated $200,000 in funds, the California Charter School Association argued in court that they weren't guilty of any criminal offense because charter schools are not subject to laws governing public schools. They're private entities. They're operated by private corporations. So, and oftentimes, the charter schools enter into lucrative deals for property management or leasing arrangements. For example, in Miami, there was a school where the landlord, the founder of the school, charged the school $900,000 in rent for leasing his property. For the school, there was a school in Oakland where more than $3 million went into the pockets of the founder of the American Indian Charter School. So the idea that these schools are subject to intense regulation is not really accurate. And actually, they do whatever they can to escape such regulation. Right now, there was just a report issued that showed that thousands of schools receiving public funds are teaching creationism. So, you know, the idea that these schools are somehow superior is really faulty. And in fact, even in looking at academic success, the schools in Minnesota, the schools in Minneapolis, there was a report a couple of years ago that showed that the charter schools in the Twin Cities metro area underperform academically in comparison to traditional public schools. They score 7.5% lower on math and 4.4% lower on reading tests than students in traditional public schools. and they're higher, they have increased the levels of segregation in these cities. So
if I might there's so many issues there.
Wait, one moment. Ms. Young, just let Mr. Cody finish, and then we'll certainly
let him hear from you.
Well,
I was just thinking there's so many. Maybe we could take one at a time. There's good questions.
Yeah, we will in just a moment.
Yeah, so you know, and what's happening is that the people that are making a lot of money on this are being very thorough at lobbying. We have organizations like K-12 Inc., which is a member of ALEC that you may have heard of, and they're introducing legislation around the country to expand vouchers for virtual charters. And virtual charters are really the least effective of these charter schools, and where the students are given a computer and they attend class an hour or two a week, and all their curriculum is online.
Okay, and Ms. Young, you wanted to address the racial, the undercurrent of what they're saying is racism.
And fundamentalism. Well,
there's so many issues here that I'd like to address, and unfortunately, I really appreciate this conversation, because one of the reasons I wrote my book is to dispel the many myths around chartering, and you have heard about 8 of them in one comment. So let me just go back to sort of some of the underlying issues. Number one, yes, charter schools are about freedom from regulation, and that is to allow the choices and innovations and the opportunities that allow children to succeed in different and new and different ways. But even though there's freedom from regulation, it is not freedom from accountability, and they still, as I said, must abide by all of the federal and state standards, both academically and financially. If they are not happening, and the gentleman indicated some of the issues that have arisen, that is usually an issue that the authorizer has not done its job. And so we do say within the charter school law that those schools should be closed if they are not meeting those facilities and that those outcomes. And that does not happen in district schools. I also want to address something else that's really, really important here. These are not private schools. They are not private entities or operated by private entities. And there is nothing like vouchers in here. I am a union-endorsed Democrat. I do not support vouchers. I never have. I would never have proposed something that would have ever been a private entity. These schools are independently run public schools, and because they are independently run, they have the opportunity to be managed by folks. And so if you look at the charter schools around the country, about 67% of all the charter schools boards are independently run, nonprofit, single-site schools. 20% are run by nonprofit organizations that run more than one charter school. So you have a network of nonprofit schools. And then just under 13% are actually managed or run by for-profit companies. And some of those are in Florida. Now, those for-profit charter schools must report to the nonprofit board of directors, and they must meet the financial oversight regulations. I will also just say this. If you look at the effectiveness of schools here in Minnesota and around the nation, it is just amazing. Many of these schools, whether for-profit, managed, or nonprofit, are A-rated schools in Florida and around this country. In Minnesota, two of our highest performing high schools are charter schools that are filled with students, 94% students of color. In the lists of America's best high schools in Newsweek and U.S. News and World Report and the Washington Post, charter schools are far more greater proportion of the best high schools. In fact, more than a quarter of the best high schools are charter schools, well out of their proportion, because only about an average of 5% of public charter school students actually, only about 5% of public school students actually attend public charter schools. So I hope this addresses some of those. Going to an earlier issue that the gentleman raised, Mr. Cody, about funding, this is the most common question, and I totally understand why you would ask that. There is a concern that the funding is taken from the districts. Actually, that is not the case. In chartering, funding follows the very student it is intended to educate, so that the child who's going to the charter school gets the money that is intended to educate that person.
How about athletics and band and phys ed and libraries and such?
Yes, many charter schools have that, or they can purchase the services from the district and pay the service, the district for that service. So what really is occurring here when you say that the district schools feel like they're, you know, they're having the money taken away, is this. They don't have control over that money, and they actually want to keep the money for fixed costs, even though their students are being reduced, the demand is reduced. So what I'm saying is very simple. Chartering means the money follows the student.
What about Mr. Cody at the beginning, and I had read that a study by the General Accounting Office showed that charter schools are less likely to serve children with disabilities. What do you say about that? Ms. Young?
Oh, I'm sorry, for me, thank you. Yes. I appreciate that question because it's ironic. As you read the pioneering charter school story, you'll find out that the second school that actually was approved and operated here in Minnesota was a school to serve students who were deaf and hard of hearing, called the Metro Deaf School. And so actually, in Minnesota, we have a higher number of students with special needs and disabilities being served by charter schools.
I don't think that's nationwide, though.
Generally nationwide, there has been an equivalent number of people with disabilities being served, or children, because it is a lottery system, and the students are picked first come, first served. So as they are chosen, they cannot be accepted or rejected on the basis of whether they have a disability. So if they are in the lottery and they are chosen, they are served.
But accountability varies by state, doesn't it, Ms. Young? And I can see Minnesota being real pulled together, but what about accountability, say, in Louisiana or something?
The special needs issues are federal. So, of course, those standards must be met in all of the 50 states. And I am actually seeing some very fine results for students with disabilities in charter schools. But, again, they are served just along with the rest of the students in the charter public school, just as they would be served in a district school.
We're speaking about charter schools.
We'll get to you, Mr. Cody.
We'll let you answer. We're talking about charter schools on today's Topical Currents. If you have a question or a point of view, if you'd like to share it with us, the number is 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576. Or you can email radio@WLRN.org, radio@WLRN.org. Okay, Mr. Cody?
Well, you know, this is not a question. This is a problem. The State Impact Florida and the Miami Herald gathered and analyzed data on K-12 students with disabilities from 14 school districts, representing more than three-quarters of Florida's total charter enrollment. The analysis focused on students in the state's two most severe disability categories, which include students with autism, Down syndrome, and cerebral palsy. It showed that more than 86% of the charter schools in Florida do not serve a single child with a severe disability, compared to more than half of the school district of the actual public schools that do. In Duval County, just one student enrolled in a charter school has a severe disability. Duval District Schools educate more than 1,000 severely disabled students. So there's no question that Florida's charter schools are not serving disabled students at the same rate that public schools are. And, you know, you can talk all you want about how they meet all the same regulations. In actual point of fact, they are not serving the numbers of disabled students that regular public schools are. And every time they are challenged on the basis of obeying the laws, then they claim that they are not public schools and that they don't have to follow those laws.
We have on the line, we'll get back to you, Ms. Young.
Sure.
Adam Miller, he's the executive director of the Office of Independent Education and Parental Choice of the Florida Department of Education. Welcome to you, Mr. Miller.
Thank you for having me.
In just kind of a thumbnail, you've been listening to our discussion. What are your feelings as an official member of the Florida Department of Education?
Well, first, again, thank you for inviting me to participate in the call, and I'd also like to first thank Mr. Cody for his service as a teacher, and thank Ms. Young as well for her service as a legislator.
Well, it's Mr. Cody.
I'm sorry?
It's Mr. Cody.
I'm sorry, did I not say Mr. Cody?
Yeah, you said Mrs.
I apologize, Mr.
Okay.
Cody. Mr. Anthony Cody, yes.
Yes.
I apologize. So, yeah, I just think this is a good discussion. I'm glad that this is something that we're talking about. I think it's important for parents and policymakers and teachers to be discussing ways that we can improve our education system.
Okay.
You know, can go on from there.
Yeah.
Do you have a specific question, or would you like me to discuss the state's...
Well, what does your Independent Education and Parental Choice Office do?
So we oversee a number of the choice programs in the state, including charter schools. We also have a role in oversight with some of the private scholarship programs, as well as home education, and some various district-managed choice programs, such as controlled open enrollment and magnet schools.
You know, from listening to each of you, it looks like statistics back up both of you. I'm thinking if we have reliable statistics regarding the performance of students at public versus public charter schools, and it seems like it's tricky because there's so many variables to take into account. So how do we get the real numbers, and how do we actually measure performance?
It is really tricky because, you know, part of the problem is that we've entered this realm where test scores are being used to make all sorts of judgments, when really the quality of a school is much more complex than that. And as a teacher, you know, I really hated to have my work judged only on test scores. For example, the school that I mentioned, the really great charter school in Albuquerque that I mentioned, they don't have good test scores because they're specifically recruiting students who dropped out. But we have this accountability paradigm where both public schools and charter schools are being judged exclusively on test scores, and it really leads to a narrowing of the curriculum and a really, really unfortunate focus on test preparation in both traditional and charter schools.
So, Mr. Miller, does the Florida Department of Education have any policies? And how do they view charter schools? I hadn't been able to get that from you.
So the department supports high-quality charter schools. We see charter schools as one option to a continuous improvement cycle within our public education system. We believe that parents should have the right to choose a high-quality school and a school that meets the needs of their child.
And what if they aren't high-quality?
I'm sorry?
What if the charter school isn't high-quality?
We have in Florida very strong outcome-based accountability provisions for charter schools. So any charter school in the state that receives two consecutive grades of F must be closed. And then we also provide authorizers who, in the case of Florida, are the local school districts. The law allows them to close a charter school for poor financial performance or poor academic performance. So if the charter is not living up, the school is not living up to and meeting the expectations that are set forth in their contract, that school can be closed.
Let's take it. I'm sorry, Ms. Young, I go ahead.
Well, I was
interrupted
going to
you.
Say, to Mr. Cody's point, I actually agree with him on the testing part of it. I don't think that test scores are the only way to evaluate the growth of a student in a charter or a district's public school, and my hope is that chartering can help to develop additional ways to do that evaluation. For example, what often happens in a charter school is that a child comes in 2 or 3 years behind. They make a lot of growth, like maybe an extra year of growth in that time, but they still don't reach the standards, so therefore it sounds like they haven't learned. So I think we do need wider and different kinds of forms of assessment. Testing, of course, is important, but it's one of many. And on that point, I just want to add my favorite thing, and that is, you know, over this last year, I've been visiting a number of charter schools around the nation, and what I see in those schools just lights up my heart and my, just, you know, in that I see this passion. I see passion from teachers and leaders, school leaders who are so engaged in the classroom and in the school, and I see students who just love to be in school, and it's a passion that I just don't necessarily see in many district schools. And, you know, I remember going into, just Pembroke Pines has a whole city of charter schools there. I visited them in November. And
I know very many very passionate, excellent school teachers here in Miami-Dade County. They've been on this program.
And they are, but oftentimes what happens is that the system is such that it doesn't allow the teachers to have that opportunity, that creativity, that ownership of what they want to do, to be creative and innovative, and therefore that does cut into some of the passion that they might otherwise have for the learning strategies.
Well, let me ask you both, what about the curricula? How do they differ between public and charter schools, or do they? Is there more arts education in charter schools?
You know, it really...
Mr. Cody?
Go ahead.
It really varies from school to school, and how much autonomy the school has really depends on what kind of accountability pressure they're under. Unfortunately, as I said, both charter schools and traditional public schools are under huge pressure to raise test scores, and so in both situations you have a narrowing of the curriculum. Some of the charter schools go to the extreme. You know, you have chains like KIPP and Rocket Ship that are really doing test prep almost all day long. And you have virtual charters like K-12 Inc., which is the largest charter school chain in the nation, is paying its CEO $5 million a year, and is educating students over the internet with the students that actually never physically meet their teacher. So, you know, there's really a wide range, and then there are other schools, both traditional and charter, that are doing things like project-based learning, like the school in Albuquerque I mentioned.
If I could jump in.
Yes, Mr. Miller.
I would like to take exception to one point that Mr. Cody just made. I think that it's a broad and unsupported claim that charter schools are narrowing the curriculum. And for example, he pointed out the KIPP schools. I'm not sure if Mr. Cody's been in a KIPP school, but I have been.
What does that stand for?
KIPP is the Knowledge is Power program. It's a chain of charter schools that serve predominantly low-income students around the country, and they've had tremendous success. And they do. They have extended school days. They have extended school years. They often have classes on Saturdays. And I can tell you that the school here in Florida, we are lucky enough to have two KIPP schools in Jacksonville. Every student in those schools has a musical instrument, and music is infused throughout the day and throughout the curriculum. So to say that they are predominantly or exclusively test preparation is just not an accurate characterization of that program.
We're going to take some calls, and we have an email. Mr. Cody, did you want to respond to that?
Well, this was my experience in Oakland, was that the students who were coming were getting bounced out of the KIPP schools who were struggling in the academically, and they reported a lot of emphasis on test preparation. So that was just my experience.
Okay. We have an emailer saying that Ms. Young, that what's going on in Florida with charter schools is they're taking essential funds from public schools, which are seriously underfunded. Also in Florida, it's a partisan issue, with the Republican Party platform supporting charter schools and vouchers for private schools. And that's from Blanca. Do you want to respond to that?
Yes, thank you. I one of the reasons, really, that I am taking a year to talk about this issue is to really restore the fact that charter schools came from the ideological middle of the political spectrum and bipartisan. They passed in Minnesota with 42% of the majority Democrats voting for it and 56% of the minority Republicans voting for it. You just can't get any more in the middle than that. And I, being a Democrat, am surprised at how partisan it has been in Florida. I was there recently, and I would love to help to make that case for Democrats that this is about public school choice, and that's why 70% of the people appreciate it and support it. I also have found many allies in the African-American communities, the communities of color, Hispanic communities, because they are able to have choices in their neighborhoods, and often they come through on the Democratic side as well. So that's my response to that. Regarding the funding, I truly understand that there is just limited funding going around, but you know, the fact of the matter is that charter schools actually do their work on less money by average than the district public schools, because they don't always get all of the different formula pieces to fund their school. So they often are asked to do more with less, and they still are achieving very high results in many cases. And again, I just want to repeat, the money follows the students. So those districts that say, wait a minute, the money's being taken from the school, you just need to think about the child goes out of the school, so does the money. What they're saying is they want to keep the money to fund their fixed costs, or what I call phantom students. And that simply doesn't make sense. It's not, and I'm a Democrat talking about it, it's just not about efficiency. And
what about, what about accountability of charter school administrator salaries?
You know, that is something that the authorizers, you know, can oversee. But the bottom line is they have autonomy to stretch the budget the way they want to do that. And many charter schools don't necessarily have, you know, the same kind of administration that district schools do. In Minnesota, we have something called teacher cooperatives, where the teachers themselves will actually run the school, and they will not even have a principal, but they're doing very well here in Minnesota. And that's one of the innovations of chartering, and one of the reasons why the union here in Minnesota has established something, the first union-initiated charter school authorizer in the country, where the union leaders are actually now authorizing opportunities for teachers to take the lead in charter schools.
We've talked a lot about it, about teachers. We need to take a break, but I'm just wondering the standards for charter school teacher certification, how they differ from those of public school, traditional public school certification?
They are the same.
But there's one exception, which is, for example, the rocket ship charters is one of these great innovations that are putting the students in groups, classes of up to 130 students, and they're being supervised by people that are not certified teachers, that are sort of facilitators, and they do this to save money. And then the students are really getting shortchanged, in my view, because I do not think having students work in front of computers has the same effectiveness as working one-on-one or even in a regular sized class with a credentialed teacher.
We're speaking with Ember Reichscott-Young and Anthony Cody and Adam Miller about charter schools, the pros and cons on Topical Currents. A break, we'll come back and take your calls, and we appreciate your patience.
And we return. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Adam Miller from the Florida Department of Education, also Ember Reichscott-Young. She is a former Minnesota legislator who first proposed charter schools legislatively, and also retired educator Anthony Cody. Let's get to some listener calls. This is Tom in Cutler Bay. Hi there.
Good afternoon. Thank you for allowing me to be on your show. My wife is a public school teacher and has been.
Could you turn your radio down?
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize you were getting the feedback from that. My wife is a public school teacher. She has been for over 36 years and has been in the same school, luckily, for most of her career.
We're short on time. Could you get to your point?
No problem. the quality of teachers in charter schools do not come up to the same standards as in the schools in Dade County. In most cases, they're low experience. They are not, in most cases, represented by union protection and things like that. In the beginning of public of the charter schools in Florida, they weren't even tested for the FCAT. Now, after about 4 or 5 years after they came in, now they fall under that category, that scrutiny of FCAT and maybe even the core programs that are coming up. Charter schools are basically based on, in my opinion, a free market system where let everybody compete. But schools are not meant to compete. Schools are meant to teach. And if you do not allow the teachers teach, but you straddle them with all kinds of paperwork and things like that. I can attest that my wife wakes up at 3 o'clock in the morning, leaves the house at 5:30. She's at school. She comes home at 6 o'clock in the afternoon. And believe me, she's not going to the gym. She's going to school. She teaches in the lower grade levels and really is a super teacher.
Ember Young, could you comment on what he's been talking about?
Well, first of all, bless your wife for being a teacher, and I know it is a very, very hard job. And you're right, there is a lot of paperwork, and a lot of that has to do with regulatory oversight. What I would like to suggest is that not every teacher is a fit for a charter public school. And there generally, and you will see that there is more turnover in the charter school teacher area, and which is usually due to the fact that I was just mentioning earlier that there is lower pay due to the lower funding that charter schools get as compared to district schools. It takes a very special type of entrepreneurial teacher to either start a charter school or to be in one. And so that's why, you know, only about 5% of the students and, you know, a similar number of teachers go into chartering. That would be my response. But I think Mr. Miller can respond more to the specifics of the Florida, you know, laws.
By all means.
Thank you. Yeah, so in Florida, the requirements for teachers are the exact same across charter and traditional public schools, the same certification requirements. So every charter school teacher has to be certified, they have to be in field, they go through the same screening process as do traditional public school teachers.
Are there pay discrepancies in Florida?
Certainly are. There are pay discrepancies within districts, within schools, across districts. So there are certainly pay discrepancies. Each charter school has a budget, and they have to operate their school within that budget. Sometimes that means they have to pay their teachers a little bit less. Sometimes they're able to pay their teachers a little bit more. Hmm.
Another caller, and I'll remind our callers I'm pretty short on time. Jack in Plantation, you're up high.
First of all, thank you for having this conversation. There's some things that I think you're missing that has not come up. Number one, charter schools could be very selective who their students are going to be. Public schools do not have that selectivity. If you stop and think, I know when I went to school, and first of all, I'm from business and industry. I'm a parent. I was active in our son's PTO 5 years as president, and today I'm a professor. So I have a little bit of all backgrounds. And while I'm not saying that I am an expert, I know from experience, one of the things that really bothers me is when I went to school, elementary school, 50 years ago, our mandatory day was 180 days a year. Today, guess what? It's still 180 days a year, but look at how much that classroom teacher has to do, especially in the social skill area, because it's not done at the home. The other thing is when we talk about online education, I am on a lot of business and industry committees. And today, We're seeing what's coming out with all online education at the post-secondary level. Companies are starting to ask applicants as part of the interviewing process, not only do they have to have an official transcript sent to the company under FERPA, we cannot do that. It has to be requested by the student. So a lot of companies are giving students the form to authorize it, and in that request is another statement from the company saying, please complete the additional form and seal it. So it's an official statement. Mm-hmm. How was the education delivered? Online, traditional, or other, to mean blended classes. And many companies are not even going through the interview process because the short experience they have encountered is that the students going through 100% or more than 50% online education, they do not possess the critical thinking.
Well, not all charter public charter schools are virtual. And we're just about out of time, Jack. Any of our panelists want to comment on that?
Well, he raises a really huge point. You're right, not all of them are, but K-12 Incorporated is the largest charter chain in the nation, and it is active in Florida, and they are actively diverting funds to very poor quality education. And I had a blog on my post, a guest post by a teacher at a K-12 Inc. school who reported really poor results and actually quit her job mid-year. Her name is Darcy Bedortha. And she wrote very powerfully about that experience with that virtual charter. So it's a big concern, even though it's not the largest sector of the charter schools, but it's still a major sector, and they're active, very active in Florida.
Well, the clock has run out on us, and I'm sure there are other comments there, but we're just running out of time.
Yes, and I do want to mention it is National School Choice Week, which we wanted to spend some time on, but we have run out of time. We've been speaking with Ember Reichscott-Young. She's a former Minnesota legislator who first proposed charter schools in 1991 and has written Zero Chance of Passage. Also with us was educator Anthony Cody, who taught for 24 years in low-income schools in Oakland, California, and Adam Miller, the Florida Department Executive Director of the Office of Independent Education and Parental Choice for the Florida Department of Education. Thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Indeed. And thanks for tuning in this hour. Sorry we couldn't get to more callers. Topical Currents is produced by Richard Ives, technical direction by online producer Paul Leary. Tomorrow's program features the history and status of solar energy. The principles go back to China around 6000 BC. Solar water heaters were widespread in Florida in the 1940s. Of course, we have free audio archives and program downloads at our website. That's WLRN.org. More information as well. Links, discussion, and photos at the Topical Currents Facebook page. And the calendar on this day in 1832, 182 years ago, the birth of English writer and mathematician Lewis Carroll in Cheshire. Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, Through the Looking Glass, Hunting of the Snark, Jabberwocky. And on this day in 1921, 93 years ago, the birth of actress Donna Reed in Denison, Iowa. She won a Supporting Actress Oscar in 1953 for playing a prostitute in From Here to Eternity, of course, starred in the Donna Reed TV shows in the 1960s. And one more while we consider the worst person in the world. On this day in 1959, 55 years ago, the birth of Keith Olbermann in New York City. He became an anchor on ESPN, then did the Countdown program, and now hosts a late-night program on ESPN2. And we leave with a thought from Keith Olbermann, quote, "I'm difficult for management. That's why I had the reputation, because nobody challenges management." Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Next up, it's Here and Now from NPR News.